From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Joy Powers. Today on the show, we examine if any of President Trump's legal challenges or recount efforts could impact the final election results. Then we learn about the Milwaukee Handicrafts Project and what it meant for women it employed.
The women who had come there for work were actually women who had never worked before outside the household. A lot of these women came from conditions that were very impoverished.
Plus, we look at some of the biggest scandals from Wisconsin's history, including the attempted assassination of President Teddy Roosevelt that left him with a bullet lodged in his chest.
He has his speech folded up in his breast pocket, and it's so thick. That plus his glasses case absorb some of this impact from the bullet and help it not to penetrate quite as deeply.
That's next on Lake Effect, but first, the news. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks for tuning in today. I'm Joy Powers. Election day was more than 2 weeks ago. The vote tally took longer than a normal election year because a record number of people voted by mail. Yet once the votes were in, Vice President Joe Biden was projected the winner. But President Donald Trump has not conceded the election. The election results will be made official after two final steps in the election process. Each state needs to certify their election results, and the popular vote gets turned into the electoral vote. Once that's complete, Wisconsin's 10 electoral votes can be cast. President-elect Biden is ahead of President Trump by about 20,000 votes in Wisconsin. The president has indicated he wants a recount, and the deadline to file is today at 5 p.m. To understand the president's legal challenges and recount efforts, WUWM's Mayon Silver spoke with Adav Noti, the senior director and chief of staff at Campaign Legal Center, a nonpartisan government watchdog group. He explains how and when election results are finalized and begins with a primer on how the Electoral College works.
In the United States, we don't directly vote for the presidency. The citizens of the country do not cast votes directly for the person who will be the next president. Instead, we elect a small number of people, which is currently 538, and those people actually cast the votes that decide who the next president would be. So each state gets a number of presidential electors that's equal to the number of members it has in the House of Representatives plus the number of senators it has, and the presidential electors, who are collectively referred to as the Electoral College, cast their votes in the middle of December, and the winner of the majority of those votes becomes the next president in January.
For people who may not understand like what the substantive difference is between having the popular vote decide the president and having these electors decide the president, I mean, if the electors are bound by the popular vote in their state, what is the concrete difference there?
So the electors in most states are required to cast their votes for whoever won the popular vote in that state. So on a state-by-state level, the popular vote does control. But at a national level, you can get a divergence between the winner of the popular vote and the winner of the electoral vote. Say if a candidate wins by a large margin in some large states, but loses by a small margin in smaller states, you can easily end up with a situation where a presidential candidate gets more popular votes nationwide, but ends up with fewer electoral votes. And in fact, this has happened several times in American history, including 2016 and 2000.
So let's fast forward to 2020. We just had an election. Can you talk about what's happening between now and election day and how that's impacting the electors?
Sure. So there are a number of steps that take place in the process of turning the votes that are cast on election day into the final results of the presidential election. The first step is for each state to finalize its results. And that's the stage that we're in now. So each state has its own laws and procedures for how it counts the votes and, if necessary, recounts the votes and produces a final certified total of the votes that were cast for president on Election Day. Then the second step, once the state has its final certified results, is for the state to appoint its presidential electors. Now, these are the members of the Electoral College from that state. They've been nominated in advance by the parties or the campaigns. So going into Election Day, you know, each state would have already nominated a number of Republican electors and a number of Democratic electors based on the total number of electoral votes that the state is allocated. And then the winner of the popular vote on Election Day, that's their nominated slate of electors are the ones who are actually appointed. And that appointment happens in most states, that appointment happens automatically when the governor or the secretary of state or whoever the chief election officer in the state is certifies those final results of the popular vote.
So right now you're telling me there's like 10 people wandering around Wisconsin for the Democrats, probably in their kitchens or working right now, but they're slated to vote for Biden. And then there are also 10 people wandering around in Wisconsin who are slated to vote for Trump. And depending on who won the popular vote, one or the other slates would be activated.
That's exactly right. That's exactly how it works. There are the number of electoral votes allocated to the state. That's the number of nominees there are for presidential electors within that state. And then each party or each candidate would have its own slate comprising that number of elector nominees. And then once the results are certified, those folks go from being elector nominees to actual presidential electors.
So before we get into, you know, some of the anxiety that some people have about which slate of electors might be nominated, can we talk a little bit about the safe harbor date? When is that in Wisconsin, and how, what does it mean?
So under federal law, each state is responsible for determining the results of its own presidential elections. And federal law recognizes that there might be disputes about the results of the elections in any given state, and there might be recounts or contests. And so what the law says is that a state gets to decide in the first instance who won the presidential election within that state. And as long as they do that by a certain date, which this year is December 8th, and as long as they do it pursuant to whatever the laws and procedures were that were in place on Election Day, that state's determination of who won its presidential election is conclusive. It's final. It can't be second-guessed later at the federal level or anywhere else. So there are two parts to that determination. One is that the state has to wrap up any contests or recounts or any other sort of disputes about its results by the safe harbor date, which is December 8th. And they have to do it pursuant to the pre-existing rules. So they can't change the rules after Election Day. If a state changes its rules after Election Day, that's actually illegal in a number of ways. But one of the many laws it would violate would be the federal law that provides for safe harbor of states' determinations of their own election results. So a state that changes the rules after Election Day isn't not entitled to the protection of federal law for its decision.
And right now in Wisconsin, you know, we're at the point of the various bodies are trying to canvass and certify the results, but we are expecting potentially on Wednesday morning there could be a recount request from the Trump campaign. It would cost them something like $8 million up front is what the election officials are saying. But do you think anything with regards to a recount could postpone the state certifying their results before the safe harbor date?
I think it's extremely unlikely that any recount would last beyond the safe harbor date. Wisconsin has conducted recounts before, every state has at one time or another conducted recounts and had contests and court proceedings, and no state of any significance has missed the safe harbor date in a very, very long time. Even in the 2000 election, with the recount in Florida and litigation that went all the way to the Supreme Court of the United States, even then, Florida did not miss the safe harbor date. So there is plenty of time for Wisconsin to conduct a recount if one is requested and paid for in advance of the safe harbor date. The state has its own certification deadline, which is December 1, and that might have to slip a little if there is a recount, and that has happened before. But that's fine, because ultimately the state has longer than that to certify its results.
And then, you know, a primary tactic of the Trump campaign beyond, you know, requesting a recount and some conservative groups has been to try to prevent the states from certifying their results or, like, delay the process. And, you know, they've been doing this through various lawsuits, arguing, bringing voter fraud allegations, saying they had evidence and then not bringing the evidence in court. In fact, that happened in Wisconsin on Monday. Do you know anything about these lawsuits and their potential impact in Wisconsin and elsewhere? And if, you know, you're expecting any other lawsuits to be brought in Wisconsin or anything like that?
Well, the only way that the campaign could really delay the certification and finalization of the presidential results in each state would be to get a court order, right? To get some sort of court order saying, hold on, it's not time to certify the results yet. And so I think that's why we're seeing a lot of litigation brought by the Trump campaign to try to delay those certifications. None of the litigation has been remotely successful to date. None of it has even actually gotten past the initial stage of scrutiny by courts, much less gotten to the point of any sort of court order. And based on the suits that are pending currently, I think it would be quite surprising if any court were to do that. And of course, in the big picture, the way the electoral vote counts look, to actually delay the finalization of the presidential election as a whole, the campaign would have to get delays in multiple states, you know, states totaling a significant number of electoral votes, to push back the date at which enough results have been certified to make Vice President Biden, you know, officially the president-elect. And I think it's going to be very difficult for the campaign to get a delay in any state, and to get a delay in enough states to make a difference is essentially impossible at this point.
So even if the state certifies the election on time, let's say none of those lawsuits work, everything goes as planned, is there any way that Wisconsin's Republican-controlled legislature could, like, go rogue and appoint the Trump electors, even if the popular vote is saying that it should be the Biden electors?
Not legally. Federal law prohibits that. So although state legislatures get to decide on the front end how a state is going to allocate its electoral votes, and, you know, currently all 50 states do that by popular vote, right? The winner of the popular vote wins the state's electoral votes. State legislatures get to decide how the electors are chosen, but under the Constitution, Congress decides when the electors are chosen, and Congress has done that for a very long time by setting an election day, which this year was November 3rd. So that's a nationwide election day. It applies to all states, and that's the day on which every state, no matter how they allocate their presidential electors, that's when they have to make the decision about who those electors are going to be. And again, in all states, that's by popular vote. After that day has passed, the legislature has no more power to change how the state allocates its electoral votes. They could change it for a future election. A state could decide for 2024, the state legislature could decide, well, we're not going to hold a popular vote anymore. We're going to appoint our members of the Electoral College by some other method. But they can't retroactively change it for 2020.
And what happens on December 14th? We've talked a little bit about December 8th. What happens, you know, 6 days later?
So on December 14th, the electoral college, the presidential electors, cast their actual votes for president. Electoral college is a little bit of a misleading term because it suggests that all the electors get together. They don't actually do that. The electors from each state meet within their own states. So there are 51 separate meetings of the electoral college, you know, one in each state plus the District of Columbia. And at those meetings, the electors cast their votes for president. They cast them pursuant to the winner of the popular vote in each state. And then they send those votes to Congress. And Congress then meets in a special session, joint session with both the House of Representatives and the Senate together on January 6th of 2021 to officially count those votes that are submitted from the meetings of the electors in each state.
What happens if there's a dispute about the electoral votes?
A dispute in Congress?
Yeah, a dispute in Congress.
So there's a federal law that specifies how any disputes about the counting of electoral votes get handled. And the basic procedure is that at the joint session of Congress where the electoral votes are counted, members of the House or Senate can object if they think there's a problem with the electoral votes that are submitted from a state. And if there is an objection, then the House of Representatives and the Senate, they leave the joint session and they meet separately. So the House meets and the Senate meets separately, and they vote on which set of electoral votes from that state are valid. If the House and Senate agree on which set of electoral votes from the state should be counted, then that's the one that gets counted, simple enough. If the House and Senate disagree, there are a series of sort of tie-breaking rules about which set of votes get counted. And the two main rules are that if a state has complied with the safe harbor rule, meaning a state has certified its the results of its presidential election by December 8th and done it pursuant to the laws as they stood on election day, then that slate gets counted, and another one that doesn't comply with those rules does not. And then the backup provision is that if there's still a dispute about which set of electors from the state is valid, then the results that are certified by the governor of the state get essentially the tiebreaker. They are the ones that are counted.
So I should have made it clear that when I was asking, you answered it great. I should have made it clear that when we're talking about a dispute, we're talking about two different panels of electors, like the Republican slate and a Democratic slate, right?
Right. Well, it could come up, a dispute about electoral votes or the counting of electoral votes could come up a number of different ways. I mean, the scenario that some had floated in the context of this election and it's not going to happen, and it was never likely to happen. But the one that some folks raised earlier in the process was, what if there's a set of electoral votes that are submitted pursuant to the popular vote in the state and certified by the governor, and then another set of electoral votes that's appointed directly by the legislature of the state? So that's the scenario in which the governor's slate gets the tiebreaker if the two houses of Congress can't agree on which one to count. Of course, the legislative leaders in all of these states, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, Michigan, Arizona, have all made clear, rightly so, that they do not, in fact, have the legal authority to just start appointing presidential electors after the election. That's not legal under federal law. But even if they were to do so, under the vote counting rules for electoral votes, if there were one set of votes submitted by a legislatively appointed slate, another submitted by a slate that was elected by the popular vote and certified by the governor's slate would be counted and the legislative slate would not.
And in some, are there any other disputes that you would see as plausible, anything to expect or to look for, or are you pretty much expecting that things will go as, like, pro forma, as you say, according to form?
Well, at this point, there's really nothing left to do except, you know, the few states that might have recounts. Wisconsin may have a recount. Georgia has already had essentially one recount and may have a second. But those are, you know, recounts do not change vote totals in any significant way. I mean, essentially the largest number of votes that have ever been changed by a statewide recount is, you know, several hundred. And the margins in all of these states are in the tens of thousands. So there's really no doubt or uncertainty left about the results of the presidential election.
All right. Well, Adav Noti, thank you so much for unpacking this for us.
Thank you.
Adav Noti is the Senior Director and Chief of Staff at Campaign Legal Center, a nonpartisan government watchdog group. He spoke with WUWM's Mayon Silver. We'll take a short break, then learn about the Milwaukee Handicrafts Project. This is Lake Effect on Milwaukee's NPR. You're listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. During the Great Depression, President Franklin Roosevelt's New Deal sought to ease the pain of many Americans and put them back to work. His Works Progress Administration employed millions of Americans to rebuild essential infrastructure like parks, roads, and housing. But the vast majority of these jobs went to unskilled men, and most opportunities for women required an education. Here in Milwaukee, a local program worked to change that. The Milwaukee Handicrafts Project hired unskilled women to, among other things, mend textbooks, build furniture, and sew dolls. Matthew Prigge wrote about the program for this month's Milwaukee Magazine, and he joins me now to talk about it. Matthew, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect.
Oh, thank you for having me.
It was really interesting reading your piece because it illuminates a part of our history that is often overlooked, specifically the conditions for women during the Great Depression, which was vastly different than the conditions for men. If you were a woman looking for work at that time, what was your lot in life?
Obviously, the work situation all over was very hard. And specifically in relief efforts, the New Deal brought in by FDR, if you were a woman trying to find, if you'd lost your job or if someone in the household had lost their job and you needed to find work in this program that was designed to put people back to work, you had a pretty narrow path to finding something. They were, for the most part, only taking women who worked in what they would call the skilled trades, nursing, teaching, things like that. Those are the two big categories. And if you were somebody who had previously done labor work, worked with your hands, or if you're somebody who was trying to get into the workplace for the first time, you really didn't have a lot of options as it was initially set up.
Yeah, it seemed like there were options for men who mostly did this kind of labor. But when it came to women, as you say, there were few options. Until, of course, here in Milwaukee, the Milwaukee Handicrafts Project. What was the impetus for that?
Well, as I was saying, with these New Deal jobs, they were limited to one per household. And men always had the preference in getting these. So if there were households led by women, specifically unskilled women, for the most part, they had to stay on the local, call them the relief rolls, what we think of as welfare today. And basically the original idea for this was just to kind of help Milwaukee County out in removing some of these people from their relief rolls. So the local WPA administrators put a woman named Harriet Clinton, who had been kind of a groundbreaker in her own right. She graduated from journalism school from Columbia University. She'd worked as a reporter in Milwaukee when that was still a pretty rare thing for a woman to work in the newspaper business. They put her in charge of creating a program that could qualify for WPA funds, but target these, and again, what they would have called the unskilled women, just to basically shift the burden of having to pay relief to these women from the local government to the federal government.
When we say unskilled, I think some people might think of what we consider maybe less skilled labor today. But a lot of these women didn't speak English necessarily. And beyond that, even those who did speak English were often illiterate.
Right. When I was using unskilled, I'm using it in the terminology of the time, which, again, for women basically meant that you didn't have training as a nurse or a teacher or one of those profession like that. But when they got this project working, they realized that a lot of these, the women who had come there for work, were actually women who had, as you said, never worked before outside the household. A lot of these women came from conditions that were very impoverished. So even using more familiar tools like scissors, they weren't very familiar with. A lot of them were undernourished. In fact, one of the first staff hires in this project was to bring a nurse on board, because a lot of these women were in poor health or even hadn't been eating enough. So it was, really a sect of Milwaukee that, if not for this project, probably would have never been brought on board for any kind of WPA work like this.
Yeah. The project itself was a little unclear at first. They had ideas for what these women would be doing, but it seemed like, to some extent, to put it, in today's terms, like busy work. But eventually, it does evolve into a lot of diverse kind of crafts that really contributed a lot. So what were the different things these women made through this project?
Right. It started out, just to get back to the point you mentioned about this, busy work or make work. The original idea it was similar to a lot of the New Deal projects through the Works Progress Administration, the WPA, was just to give people something to do. The adage that you pay one person to dig a hole and you pay another one to fill it back in. The original idea was pretty basic, just to make scrapbooks for county institutions, hospitals, orphanages, things like that, just to give people something colorful to look at. And Harriet Clinton, who was in charge of this, she reached out to a colleague of hers named Elsa Ulbricht, who was an art teacher in Milwaukee, and she dismissed this idea. She wanted this to be actually, what we call useful work, building things that were more advanced than, just pasting photos in an album. And she was the one who really drove the more artistic end of this. As you mentioned, they ended up doing very wide variety of different projects. They ended up having 11 different units that were, each unit was tasked with doing a different craft. There was a bookbinding unit, there was a doll making unit, a toy making unit, a furniture making unit. Eventually, they really branched out from this original idea of just giving these women something to do. And each of these units had a local artisan or teacher put in charge of it, who would design the projects, who would basically teach these women how to make this stuff. And they ended up building some really beautiful materials that lasted. Some of them are still in use today.
They made a lot of these things as well out of, it seemed like, found objects.
Yeah, this was a very resourceful project. The federal government basically took care of everyone's paychecks, and that was it. They needed to be self-sustaining on everything, materials and everything like that. So they were allowed to sell some of this stuff, but they could only sell it to tax-supported institutions, and they could only sell it at the cost of their products. So to get started, they had to use a lot of found materials for their sewing unit. When that first got going, they were actually, they got a big supply of surplus burlap from the government and unwound the burlap to use the actual individual threads from that for sewing. Local companies that had excess materials would donate them. Even the bookbinding unit, they would make collections of magazine articles and bind them for local institutions. That was stuff that was just, basically taken right out of the garbage.
Yeah. The Milwaukee Handicrafts Project was actually one of the few integrated programs in the WPA. How did that come to be?
The WPA itself was, it was supposed to be, the Roosevelt administration insisted that there be no discrimination in it, but a lot of that, the actual implementation of that was left to local administrators, and the thinking among people in that position at the time, generally, which, I mean, we can see today that this is pretty nakedly racist, but their thinking was that African-Americans had a lower standard of living and were therefore, you know, less in need of this kind of relief. So that led to, obviously, a lot of discrimination within trying to dole these jobs out. But again, Elsa Elbrecht, who was at the head of this, she rejected that idea. There were actually about a few hundred, at the onset, there were a few hundred African-American women who were assigned to the project, but they were assigned to an alternative work site aside from the main one. And when she found out about that, she had them all, she wanted everybody to work in the same place. She didn't want this to be segregated in any way. And that was, it was really through her will that allowed that to happen. And again, that was a fairly integrated WPA projects were pretty rare.
So the project itself starts to break apart around the start of World War II. And you see this shop go down and down and down until the project eventually ends. That being said, what do we see as the legacy of the Milwaukee Handicrafts Project today?
Well, I think the legacy, the most visible legacy, I guess you could say today, is the things that they made. The photography in the piece that's in Milwaukee Magazine this month, those were all items that came from the UWM Archives Department. They have the Ulbricht papers there. And a lot of the artwork that survives is there. So it's in these institutions. The doll making unit that they had, those are still around today. Those are among doll collectors very prized. The furniture they made was still in use, possibly today, still at least as of very recently. It's kind of hard to go around and check up on these things right now, but I know at the public library downtown, they still had furniture that they made. The high school in Shorewood, I believe, also had some furniture that they made. But I'd say that the real legacy of this was in the 5,000 plus women who found work there, who were able to make a better living for their household. A lot of the women who worked on the project ended up finding better jobs. I don't know if I call it a complaint, but one of the issues that the administrators had in running this was that they had such high turnover among their workforce because other WPA projects, they found out that, you know, the women who came from the handicrafts project really knew what they were doing. They were very skilled. So a lot of them got better paying jobs elsewhere within these New Deal jobs. A lot of them got jobs in the private sector. So I think that it's a little harder to measure than what you'll find in the archives or in furniture in a library today. But, that's 5,000 people who were able to better themselves through this project.
All right. Well, Matthew Prigge, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect and sharing your work.
Oh, thanks for having me. It's always a thrill.
Matthew Prigge is a writer whose article on the Milwaukee Handicrafts Project was featured in this month's Milwaukee Magazine. Coming up, we'll learn about some of Wisconsin's storied and scandalous history. That's when Lake Effect returns in a moment on WUWM. Lake Effect continues now on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. History can sometimes feel like a dry topic. A world made up of men in white wigs and pressed coats making important and dispassionate decisions. In reality, there have always been scandals that have shaped our collective history, including here in Wisconsin. Author Anna Lardinoy writes about many of these defining moments in her new book, Storied and Scandalous Wisconsin, a history of mischief and menace, hero and heartbreak. She joins me now to talk about it. Anna, thank you so much for being here on Lake Effect.
Thank you so much for having me. I am delighted to share with you some more wild tales about Wisconsin.
You know, it's interesting when we think about our history, especially as it's taught to us, I think we really play down the salaciousness to focus on, you know, what we consider more serious things. But your book, of course, really digs into these scandalous stories. What was it like for you doing this research?
Well, it was a whole lot of fun. It was absolutely fascinating because not only was I digging through some of our more scandalous history, but I was also able to kind of put into context how we got to where we are now. So I found it really fascinating that Wisconsin was imagined as a dry state, which I find incredibly ironic because today we are one of the most hard drinking states in the nation. So when I was looking at prohibition and immigration and how that all happened, I can see how the pendulum swung to where we are now. And when you look at these scandalous stories, you can see a lot of that and how we get to the places that we are today.
It was interesting. Of course, the book mentioned the county where I grew up, Walworth County, was a dry county. And of course, now it is not. What were some of those surprising stories that you came across as you were doing this book?
Well, I think that the story that found me was the story of the police chief who was caught in a love triangle that resulted in the murder of his lover. I came across it when I was actually investigating a mob hit from the same era that's in the book, because there's a section on organized crime in Wisconsin. And this case was breaking around the same time. And how I do a lot of my research is just by reading old newspapers. So I continued to see headlines for these stories and they just drew me in. And then when I discovered this love triangle and that this police chief's wife killed his lover with his own revolver, and it just got so sordid, it was a story that wanted me to tell it. And so I think that that was one of the more surprising ones. And it's not all morbid. There are some slightly sweet stories, but scandal usually goes along with tragedy.
It does. I mean, one of the stories that really stuck out to me, I think there are going to be few Milwaukeeans who don't know about runaway slave Joshua Glover and his release. The city takes a lot of pride in this story, but one of the people most closely associated with it, at least at the time, was Sherman Booth, who had a major scandal.
It is a horrible story, and it's hard to believe that anything is named in his honor after that, to be perfectly frank. It was one of the most scandalous things that happened in its day. And when you read the transcripts of that trial, and for people who don't know what we're talking about, Sherman Booth is later accused of raping a 14-year-old babysitter. And she is such an innocent that she does not even realize what's happening to her. She just knows that it's a bad thing. And Sherman Booth basically admits that he did this to her father and offers him money to keep it quiet. But the father, even during this era, is livid. And Sherman Booth says, if you publicize this, it's going to be bad for your daughter. And Carolyn Cook's father does not care. He wants to see justice served. And Sherman Booth is right. They make this girl seem terrible. She's accused of wearing short sleeve dresses to school. It's scandalous. And when you are reading through the transcripts, one thing that really struck me is at a time when there is really no sex education, the newspapers are having complicated conversations about things like hymens. So I have to imagine that this scandal also educated the city on a lot of different aspects of sex. At the end of the day, he is never punished for this in the courts, but his wife leaves him. You know, he is persona non grata, and he ends up having to go to Illinois and start his life over again. So he's definitely a scandalous figure. And I actually tell this story sometimes on one of my tours because we're in Yankee Hill, where a lot of his things happened. But I tell people this in order to kind of make them feel better about our current political situations, just to point out that things have always been kind of terrible. We've been able to overcome it, and we'll be able to overcome this as well.
It must be interesting reading through those newspapers from that time and seeing the story kind of go back and forth because, you know, as you mentioned, Sherman Booth said that this would be very difficult for this young woman. It was very difficult for her, but, you know, things kind of swung both ways. What is it like having that outside perspective, looking at, you know, people really dealing with this situation as it's happening?
Well, it's really fascinating because not only are you looking at it to watch how it plays out, but I can't get away from the fact that I am looking at it through my modern framework. And so my ideas about the things that are happening are often different, and especially because I am a woman. And a lot of these stories involve women being victimized and women doing violent things to try to take back power in their own lives. And so I look at that from a definite different perspective than it played out in the 1800s. And it's really hard for me to separate those two things. And I think that that plays out a lot in the tone of my pieces, even when I try not to do that, just because it's being filtered through who I am.
You have to come at it with your whole self. You know, you can't, of course, divorce your personhood from your writing. That would be, in some ways, disingenuous.
Well, it's somewhat interesting to me because I was working with a female editor on this, and even though we are both modern women, living in this contemporary time, we did look at things differently. And she really took me to task a few times on the way that I presented the tale of the woman who was shot down in Madison in front of a grocery store. I told the story through the framework of that this man was a manipulative murderer. And she said I was being far too harsh on him, that the woman who was killed was leading him on. A lot of people don't realize, especially if you're a smaller writer like me, your editor has a lot of influence in how stories are actually shaped.
Yeah. Now, there were a lot of things that happened here in Milwaukee. There was one event that you mentioned right at the top, a famous event that I'd heard of before, of course, but I hadn't known it was in Milwaukee until I moved here. The attempted assassination of Teddy Roosevelt. For listeners who may not be familiar with it.
Well, Teddy Roosevelt, and this story, is running as a third-party candidate. And he is touring the country in order to support the Bull Moose Party and his own presidency. And this is another story where that social fabric falls apart because at the center of the story is a very mentally ill man who has had dreams that he has been told to kill Roosevelt to prevent him from starting this third party and ruining the country. And he's been following Roosevelt around the country, but Roosevelt just didn't realize it. So they finally meet up here in Milwaukee. And Roosevelt is standing outside waving to a throng of fans. And he is shot in the chest by this man. Well, there are some great historic photos of people diving towards the shooter in the crowd, and they manage to secure him. Roosevelt does get wounded by the bullet. He gives his speech anyway, which he does not condense in any way. He's speaking for nearly an hour. He's bleeding through the entire time. And part of the fun part of retelling this story is that the thing that really prevents him from dying is that he has his speech folded up in his breast pocket. And it's so thick that plus his glasses case kind of absorb some of this impact from the bullet and help it not to penetrate quite as deeply. But to Roosevelt's dying day, he lived with that bullet in his chest. Lodged in a rib. The man who shot him eventually spends the remainder of his days in a psychiatric institution. But now this becomes part of fun Milwaukee lore, and you can actually see the marker where this happened if you go to the downtown Hyatt.
So to take a kind of interesting turn. We so often have you on to talk about the supernatural. And it's, I guess, no surprise that your book includes just a touch of that. And there was a man that became famous for his psychic ability. Tell us a bit about this man, Arthur Price Roberts.
Yes. He is one of my favorite characters in Milwaukee. He is, for a time, one of Milwaukee's most famous citizens, and he's definitely one of the most well-known psychics in the country. Some people even called him the American Sherlock Holmes, because like that character, he would meet people and reveal something unnerving about them, but rather than observation, he claimed that it came from his psychic powers. And he's definitely famous throughout the arc of his life. He is hired by a bank to find out who robbed one of their banks, and he decides to have a séance. And that seance results in a name, and that person is arrested and goes to trial. He is able to find dead bodies just by using the power of his mind. But how he really launches himself into the history of Milwaukee is when he correctly predicts that there's going to be a series of bombings in Milwaukee in 1935. Now, some people know this story, that we had a number of bombings. The Shorewood Village Hall is dynamited, two First National Banks, later on a police substation gets dynamited, and all of this is foretold by Doc Roberts. And he even predicts the way it's all going to end. It is all entirely correct, but if we're looking at it through a modern framework, you can definitely see it's also very vague. But that particular case actually is still used to this day in some circles as evidence that psychic phenomena exists. So fascinating character. And I think one of the most interesting things about him is that his last official prediction was probably his most important. He correctly predicted his own death due to natural causes. Just a little fun fact.
Yeah. It's interesting looking back at these kinds of stories. And for you, who have spent so much of your career digging into the kind of bizarre past of our community especially, what do you think is the benefit of retelling and learning about them?
Well, I think it's multifold. I think just on a basic level, it's extremely entertaining. And I think that it helps us draw parallels between the past and the present, because we see that people are really never altogether that different. So especially in times that we live in now, where people feel like this is the end. No, we've always been like this. These things have always happened. It is part of the human experience. So I think in that sense, it's both entertaining and comforting. But I also think when we look at the events that happened in the past, we better understand the world in which we live in today, because we see the things that happen to create the laws that we live with, to create the social structure that we have agreed to live by. And so I know that seems like a more serious look at some really entertaining stories, but I think if you're really looking at this type of work as a collection, that's definitely what you get out of it. How do we get to where we are today is always found in the past.
Yeah. Anna, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect and sharing your work.
Thank you so much for having me, Joy. It's always a delight to talk with you.
Anna Lardinoy is a local historian, tour guide, and the author of Storied and Scandalous Wisconsin. Coming up next, we share a poem that gives one perspective of living in a pandemic. That's when Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM. More of Lake Effect Now, I'm Joy Powers. As we continue to live through the coronavirus pandemic, many of us find ourselves longing to do the simple things, like opening the door for friends or commuting to work. Former Milwaukee Poet Laureate Brenda Cardenia's poem, called When We Open Doors, gives one perspective of life in a pandemic. It's featured in a new anthology called Through This Door, Wisconsin in Poems. Wisconsin Poet Laureate Margaret Rozga is a co-editor of this anthology and will feature an interview with her about the book in the near future. For now, we'd like to share her reading of When We Open Doors.
When we open our door, we gulp the morning breeze, turn our cheeks to clear skies or the wash of rain, listen to birdsong flooding, squirrel chatter congregating in the silent streets. When we open our door, neighbors wave from porches, relieved to see us still standing. We shout across yards to ask after elders and their emptying cupboards, after brothers overseas, after kids who miss hoops, tag, and double dutch. When we open our door, feet flex, grateful for each step away from walls and worn hallways. Wrists and fingers relax, thanking arms for each swing away from keyboards. Eyes feast on glassy rivers, clearing minds of screens, clutter, pixelated headaches. When we open our door, we pass deer grazing in a cemetery filled with lonely stones. Somehow, 6 feet may keep the gravedigger at home. So we give wide berth to the jogger, decide to make do with what's left in the kitchen, and turn toward the house, our clunker still sitting in its spot, not coughing a single carbon emission. As we open our door, I tell you humans should quarantine 3 months each year to reduce Earth's fever, clear her congested lungs, smoggy skies, cloudy streams, to give bees, coyotes, foxes, chickadees their 6 feet of peace times 10. When we open our door, our phones, our laptops, we dream of touching the faces on our screens, of locking eyes and kissing cheeks. We dream of real meadows, milkweed and monarchs carrying the spirits of our dead to gather in forests of fir trees. We dream of opening our door.
That was Wisconsin Poet Laureate Margaret Rozga reading Brenda Cardenia's poem called When We Open Doors. The poem was written for the new anthology called Through This Door, Wisconsin in Poems. We'll feature an interview about the book soon. And that is today's edition of the show. I'm Joy Powers. Thank you so much for tuning in today, and please join us again tomorrow at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. It's 11 o'clock, and stay tuned. Fresh air is next.